Blog Talk Radio.
Good Friday to everybody. It's a big one today. The United States men's national team plays Panama tonight in the Do or Die World Cup qualifier. I'm Neil Blattman. Carter Christian will return later this week with some conversation kind of about these qualifiers. We'll get into the Trinidad and Tobago match that follows. But right now, all eyes are on Panama. And I did have a conversation with Daryl Grove of one half of the wonderful Total Soccer Show about this particular qualifying match. We talked a lot about the roster, a lot about what kind of challenges Panama presents. There's also a pretty lengthy discussion about Fabian Johnson, which ends up being clairvoyant because we recorded it before he was left off the roster. And then thanks to the wonderful Hurricane Irma, I had all sorts of technical difficulties because basically just a lack of internet access and studio access to post the conversation. But I wanted to make sure, you know, out of goodness to Daryl for his time, and so that anybody that has a chance to, you know, listen to this before tonight's game or wants to on their drive home gets a chance to hear, you know, a lot of the things that Daryl had to say, because he has some really awesome and interesting ideas about kind of where the national team is. So without any further Freddie ado, this is my conversation with Daryl Grove.
Good morning, and I have on the line Daryl Grove, who is one part of Total Soccer Show, which is an essential portion of any time I'm in a car, which in my line of work is a lot. I'm really glad that Daryl could join us today. I think that what you and Taylor do in terms of covering the sport in our country is extraordinarily important. It's not just fun. But I think what I like about it is this is a really rapid response time. Like, we used to make fun of these, you know, here's three things, 800-word columns that we would write about, like, after a game, that so much that we stopped doing them. And now we're, like, inspired to do them again because we think, yeah, if we could do 800 words, these guys get on and they'll do like a 30-minute show and then watch a painful game over again and do an hour-long show, you know, and then to have it as often as you guys have it. So thanks for what you do, Daryl Grove.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, obviously we enjoy doing it. It's the main reason to do it, right? Don't do anything that you don't enjoy doing. I'd say that the reason we're able to do those sort of quick tank shows and have some sort of I'd say fairly sensible things to say, it's because we've done the rewatch shows so many times that we love. There's a bit of muscle memory going on there. Do you know what I mean? Like, we know what we're looking for, I think, at this point. But it's mostly just practice to get to that point where we're able to do that.
Well, it's excellent, and it's I think it's a great service where we're still, as much as media has caught up soccer-wise in terms of coverage of the U.S., I think that other platforms, not just that, I mean written media or online internet media, I think other platforms are still somewhat lagging behind. Like, you know, I mean, there's not much post-game show action. I think now they finally have one on Sirius. It's like, there aren't a lot of games in town, and you guys are, I think, the best of those.
And I was saying there were definitely, there's three things, articles, they can be really good, right? If the three things are things that nobody else has noticed or they're important insights, then I think it's really useful. But if the three things are just like, the draw's not as good as a win, you're not really adding much to the conversation there.
Right. So let me ask you this, and I think I know the answer just from listening to y'all, but, and you know, maybe you and Taylor, if we were nuanced about it, probably had some different explanations, but I wrote a piece a week and a half ago where I essentially made the argument that CONCACAF is a little better. It's certainly better now than it has been, and it might be a little bit better perception-wise than it's given credit for, and yet, and maybe we should have learned that from Mexico, right? But it's still somewhat surprising how poorly the United States have played in really the last two rounds of qualifying, not just the hex. Is that kind of where you are?
Yeah, well, first of all, I wish I'd read that story. I guess I'll be checking thehexagon.com later to find that. But yeah, I bear in mind, I've only been in the US like 11 years, so I've only seen so many rounds of World Cup qualifying, but it seems to me that teams, especially when you get to the hex stage, have gotten much, much better than previously. And I want to even maybe blame Major League Soccer for that, because it's given maybe days. But yeah, when you take it all together, this is not where we expected to be with two games to go.
I think that's part of the allure and maybe the charm and also the unfairness of international soccer is just that the sample sizes are so small.
Yeah.
Things take such radical turns so quickly. And I agree, back to your point on MLS, you will like the article that I wrote that it's not because I said anything particularly profound, but rather when I was able to talk to Jorge Luis Pinto about 2 weeks ago, that was the remark he made, is that, hey, here's a region I've been coaching in a while, and for whatever reason, U.S. soccer hasn't bridged the gap in terms of improving their quality so much as CONCACAF has benefited, you know, sort of writ large from the presence of MLS and the improvement of MLS.
There's also an argument that a lot of people make that the big money that's offered to, say, Jozy Altidore and Michael Bradley to pull them back to Major League Soccer when they definitely could have been playing somewhere in Europe. I mean, if you buy into the idea that anywhere half decent in Europe is better than playing Major League Soccer, then it has hurt those guys' careers. I'm still sort of on the fence about that, but I can definitely see that there's an argument there.
Yeah.
So it's given other CONCACAF players like a mid-level thing to go for, and it's given the top-end US players a mid-level thing to get pulled back to when they could have gone somewhere a bit better.
Yeah. No, I think that's true, and I think, you know, you look at players that might be playing in the Panamanian League or the Honduran League, and you know, there's an argument to be made that playing in USL or playing sparingly in MLS is just better for them because of the competition. Whereas the, you know, as you just pointed out, the opposite might be true for a Jozy Altidore. Certainly, I think it's almost inarguable, as much as I like Michael Bradley, that it wasn't the most productive thing for him to do career-wise to come home when he did.
You can also say that if you're going to be paranoid about it, you should say as well, they're all spying on us. They come here playing through Major League Soccer, and they're getting a good long look really regularly at US national team players, so they're sort of more familiar when they come up against, say, Michael Bradley. They kind of know more than his strengths and his weaknesses, as opposed to just being on this. That dude that plays for Roma, I'm scared of him.
No, that's a terrific point. I think what's interesting is that I don't get caught up too much in these. There's a narrative that, oh, well, sometimes countries are between cycles. You hear that a lot. And
yeah.
I think it's kind of nonsense because, you know, Christian Pulisic, for example, was doing Rabonas in Pennsylvania at the beginning of this cycle. So it lasts a long time. But I do think there's something, too, maybe that because of the struggles in the prior round and this round, maybe some of the younger faces that we would integrate into the team that could potentially help long term, like there's a delay on that. I don't know what the tax is on that, what the cost is, but I think it's interesting. Like I saw Bruce Arena said yesterday, not sure we can have new faces. Were you surprised? Did you see that he had made those remarks? Did that surprise you?
I did. I saw it through your Twitter, I think. Did you retweet or quote tweeted Lewis Garza?
Yeah, I did.
That's where I saw it, and then I retweeted as well. So between us, we're spreading the word. yeah, didn't you say, I think Bruce Arena said something about we don't have the luxury of bringing in new faces?
Yeah.
Which, I don't know the context of, like, when he was asked the question, what it involved, but to me, it's probably Weston McKennie related, if anyone's seen him start for Schalke the last two games. It's quite easy to imagine him being added to the US men's national team midfield and how that might change the shape of it a little bit. But specifically or not, Bruce Arena is essentially saying, yeah, maybe, but not in October, because we've got Bongo with the experienced guys who can play against Panama and Trinidad and Tobago.
Right. Yeah, and Tobago. Don't want to forget Tobago. One question I had was, what's the definition of new faces, right? Because you're right, like, it's exclusive to Weston McKennie. Okay, sure. But if this means, yes, I'm not going to go have my third sit-down chat with Timothy Chandler, and we're back to the, once more to the bridge with Grant Lucy, I'm maybe a little...
Yes.
I'm maybe a little concerned about that.
Maybe we just have to wrap DeAndre Yedlin in cotton wool.
Graham Zusi is an odd way to kind of segue to Panama, but also maybe the perfect way to segue to Panama. because they're a little different under Gomez than they were under the Dele Valdez brothers. I think, let me ask you, like, what I've seen, and I rewatched to kind of prepare to talk to you, because I said, I better be on my A game. I rewatched about an hour of the first game that they played in the Hex against Panama, I did not watch any of the Gold Cup match. And I thought I thought that Panama had a bit more of the ball this cycle than they used to have. And he likes to push his wingers up. And their kind of formation seems to sort of depend on where those two wingers play, Quintero and who's the other guy that's in Mexico? Edgar Barcenas. He's a youngster.
He worries me as well. He's the one who, I believe, we call him butt-megged. Is that correct?
Yeah.
He slipped the ball underneath him and was away from Panama's goal against the U.S.
Yeah. And that actually led to the move to Croatia, I think, which didn't go very well, I guess. They loaned him immediately, but...
Wait, he's in Croatia?
Well, he signed with RNK Split. I may have said that entirely wrong, but... That's my English pronunciation of the Croatian club name. If you're an RNK Split fan, hit me up on Twitter. Tell me how to say it right.
Oh, your tongue is going to be flooded.
My angry Everton fans.
But so are you saying that he went there, but now he's on loan in Liga MX?
Yes. They loaned him right back to Liga MX. But so what I noticed is when they push the wingers up, that's what they've done at home. They play more of a 4-3-3. But when they're away, they sit them deeper. And traditionally, it looks more like a 4-5-1 or a really, really flat 4-4-2, right?
Yeah.
I don't know that I would do that against the United States if Graham Soucy's the right back. Like, I might just be like, look, I know we have a one-point lead in the Hex standings, but I think we disadvantage ourselves if we don't put pressure on Soucy.
Yeah, and the same if it's Marcus Beasley as the left back. I think he's also susceptible to someone running at him.
Right.
The thing that gives me hope is I think it's going to be Yedlin and Villafania, which I think is a little more solid and a little more... Well, it's basically faster is what it is.
Yeah.
They're not just susceptible to people running past them. And then they both add quite a lot to the attack as well. And I'm thinking about what Panama's going to do. Isn't a draw kind of okay for them?
Yes.
I wouldn't be surprised if they come to the US, to Orlando, right? They come to Orlando and decide to be a little more conservative because they can get away with just a point.
Yeah, I think a lot of conditions favor them. You mentioned they have the point that advantage they have where they can play for a draw.
Yeah.
In a lot of sports, that's bad. In soccer, not as bad. And they're just really good defensively. They've only conceded 5 times in the Hex. You know, yeah, I mean, I think that's...
Roman Torres, right? Roman Torres is the guy with
them. Yeah, well, Roman Torres. Then they have two young guys that I really like. Fidel Escobar, who was with Sporting Portugal. I think he's with the Red Bulls now. And another guy is Eric Davis, who's a left back. And he's... I hate to make the kind of short, undersized, speedy fullback is like DeAndre Yedlin. But if there's one player that's like DeAndre Yedlin in CONCACAF, it's probably Eric Davis. Trust me, watch some video. He was a star on their U-20 teams that were pretty...
They could meet down that flank if they sort of advance to the halfway line and then they sort of challenge each other to a duel. That could be exciting.
And then the other thing that that's so good about that team is just Godoy in the middle is...
Yeah.
I just think he's terrific.
I do too, but I've got to be honest, apart from seeing him play for Panama against the US, I've mostly seen highlights for San Jose.
Uh-huh.
And I think, obviously, every player always looks better in highlights, so I'm kind of, like, terrified of him chipping that keeper or anything like that. But I don't know enough, like, seeing him regularly play 90 minutes. Basically, if he was as good as I think he is, then I think San Jose would be doing a lot better this year.
That's fair. I don't know. He can be a little foul heavy. Just looking at him statistically, I'm not sure what that means. I'm in the same boat as you, where traditionally what I've seen is highlights. I might have watched one or two Earthquakes games in their entirety and thought, oh, there's Godoy, he's good.
Right. Yeah, I think he was all action, which I guess can lead to a lot of yellow cards, right? If you sort of throw yourself around a lot.
Yeah. He's a marauder, but he's a much more tethered one. Right, like it's not like Jermaine Jones where you just kind of walk about all over the field. and I wanted to ask, you mentioned Villafania. I mean, you guys seem to like Villafania a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, is it just what he offers getting forward, or do you think maybe he's a little bit better defender than some give him credit for?
I think he's at least 1v1. It comes down to pace, actually. I saw DeMarcus Beasley just get burned a few too many times just for not quite being fast enough. So Villafania at least offers sort of, if someone does just try and push and run past him, he can keep up with them. But the thing, but I would also accept that he's not paramount in it, right? When he gets forward, what I really love is the Villafania commitment to the 1-2. He's always looking for that sort of combination 1-2. So whether it's Fabian Johnson or Darlington Nagbe out there, I like the idea of him sort of linking up and getting down there. And then his crossing is not perfect, but it's also not something that I'm super, I wouldn't say he can't cross a ball. It's just that he's not, say, left-footed David Beckham. To me, this is the thing with the entire US teams, right? There are strengths at every position. Like, every position has someone you can point to their strengths, but you can also point to their weaknesses. That's why I think maybe this is true for all of the national teams, but I've just thought about the US team the most. It seems like a massive jigsaw where none of the pieces 100% fit together, and you've just got to do the best you can to sort of make it look like the picture on the box.
No, I think that's...
Which is a plane flying to Russia.
I think that's a really astute point, and I would bring up two kind of conversations that I've had that there are people that agree with you that are closer to the team than you or I are. I had an assistant for a piece I'm doing on Fabian Johnson tell me this is clearly the second most technically gifted player the Americans have, and his quote was, "It's not even close." So my follow-up was, well, what's wrong? Because you get all sorts of weird explanations. There's the nativist, and I'll just call them that, that are like, oh, he just doesn't care. That's nonsense. There's, I think, one thing he mentioned is that he's not necessarily a 1-2 kind of player. Like, he's somebody that likes, if he's on the ball, he wants to engage and attack defenders. And so when he's in a group with, say, Michael Bradley and Darlington Nagbe, who are guys that are, maybe looking for triangles a bit more, like, that's not something that he's as comfortable with, if that makes sense.
Yeah, he seems to me like he wants to burst through the back line more. Like, I've seen him play it wide, but then not go to receive the next pass, like, which is a classic 1-2, you just advance 5 yards and then you do the next one. It's more like he'll play it wide to say Villafania, or he'll play it inside to say Bradley, and then his move is to just go between the right back and the centre back and just try and break through the line immediately. So he's definitely all about going to goal.
Yeah, it seems like that's an argument for Pulisic central as a complement, just that you have somebody that wants to bust the seams of a defense. But, I don't know. I think long term, I operate under the assumption that the U.S. will somehow find a way to get to Russia, even if it's a November playoff. I haven't decided if I'm going to pick them to get through automatically or not. I'm actually leaning.
Right.
I'm leaning no. But I don't know. But I think that, and our friend Matt Tomaszewicz, he told me, he thought, Fabian Johnson seems to me to be the one puzzle that they have to figure out. Like, if they're going to be successful in Russia, it's the guy that, however they do it, they either need to say, okay, it's not going to work, or they need to get him going.
I agree with that. I feel like the thing with the US, the jigsaw type thing that I talked about, is maybe the way, I'm not picking anyone specifically, but maybe the way to get the most out of everybody in the field is to leave out one of the pieces that doesn't make sense to leave out. I'm not saying it should be Johnson, but I'm also saying I don't know who it should be. But it seems like the way that you get people most comfortable with things that connect with them the best is there's always someone who has to be sort of like pushed aside for that reason.
Right. No, I think
so. It's Neil, just interjecting here. Obviously, this conversation proves to be a bit clairvoyant, and both of us kind of outline, probably what I would imagine at least factored somewhat into the thought process in omitting Fabian Johnson. Bruce Arena said yesterday at a press conference that Johnson would certainly be somebody in their plans should they advance to the World Cup, but pretty interesting that obviously the U.S. chose to try life without him first.
That's it. And you know, at present, it might be Johnson, if we're being honest.
Maybe.
It's been a while since there's been a good performance. I thought he was a little better against Trinidad and Tobago than a lot of people did. But the overwhelming weight of analyst authority is against me.
Well, then the big thing that I can argue that the big choice Arena is having to make is he seems to like Nagby as a central midfielder, but doesn't 100% trust him. And I think that's the thing. Like all Nagby's strengths, like, you know, I'm a big Nagby fan. He doesn't offer a lot of sort of physical strength or size in the middle, so you can lose those battles. Like you know, he could sort of run him over maybe if he's playing central midfield.
Right.
But it seems to me his favourite spot seems to be like left-sided attacking midfielder. He seems to do the most damage from there. But that's also Fabian Johnson's favourite spot, right? And then you have to, if you want both of them in the team, then one of them's going to have to play out of position. I think we saw it in the early Bruce Arena games, right? Didn't he try? I think he tried Fabian Johnson on the right and Nagby on the left, or he tried Nagby on the right and Fabian Johnson on the left. And we've never had a game where they were both firing on all cylinders because they can't both play on the left.
Right. No, that's true. And you know, and I agree that I think it's interesting to talk to the Timbers fans about it because it seems like they all definitely think he should be wide.
Yeah, and they've been thinking about this for longer than any of us.
Yeah, and I mean, right. I think that's instructive. I also thought it was instructive that the U.S. really, really needed to play. It doesn't have to be Alejandro Bedoya. I know that's like a player that elicits all ends of the spectrum of takes, but you know, the U.S. kind of needed that engine to track back and to connect Bradley, and it's not even that. It's like the Bobby Warshaw piece, right? Like, who wants to demand the ball? Like, Bedoya is a guy who will show for the ball if he is anything at all. So it's interesting because it kind of, if you play Pulisic centrally, maybe. I mean, what do you think? Do you think, then do you need someone like Bedoya to sort of link Michael and Christian, or?
Yeah, so that's the thing I keep, I'm going to try and give you the best answer I can, but the thing I have going around my head is that in the Honduras home game, I think Arena went with Michael Bradley at the number 6, and Christian Pulisic ahead of him as a kind of attacking midfielder, and then two strikers ahead of him. And when I saw that, I thought, oh no, we're going to leave Michael Bradley all kinds of exposed. And then we go and win 6-0. So in my head, that shape doesn't work because I'm up on Michael Bradley, but one of the cons of Michael Bradley is, to me, he's sort of not really fast at sort of closing space on the counter and not aggressive enough to just step to the ball and win it. He tends to be more cerebral and back off, and then he gets sort of overwhelmed if there's a number of players running at him on the counter-attack, right? Which,
right.
You know, it's a tough job to be the number 6 on your own, facing, you know, like the 300 Spartans who are coming at you. So I'm worried about any formation that has Pulisic central, Bradley behind him, and no sort of, I guess you would call it a number 8, no, like, other midfielder to be the go-between between them, someone who can sometimes sit next to Bradley and sometimes go and join Kelly Acosta. But as I mentioned with the jigsaw stuff, then if you're going to do that, you've got to sacrifice probably a striker, right? Then you can't have 2 strikers and 3 central midfielders and 2 wingers unless you're going 3 at the back, but then you really don't have 2 wingers, you have 2 fullbacks. And
right.
It's sort of this cascading effect of, oh, but we don't have that, oh, sure, we should do this, oh, but then we don't have that. That's the jigsaw problem to me, is nothing ever 100% fits together. You always try to change something to fix a problem and then you create a new problem.
Yeah, precisely, and I think that's right. And I was going to say that there's your jigsaw puzzle problem.
Yeah.
And it's weird because after the Honduras match, I wrote quite confidently and I was like, oh, well, it turns out that just wherever you play Pulisic is the domino that controls everything else. And you decide where you want Pulisic to play and then everything falls into place. And that's not true.
Right.
You know, I mean, there might be a best place for Pulisic in this team. But I still think it's central based on the performances we saw in the last 2 qualifiers. But we also have to remember that you just turned 19 and you're prone to have, you know, a troublesome game. And I thought, you know, even in the Honduras game where he was clearly not very good, you know, I think the Acosta free kick was a foul that he earned, was it not?
Yes, it absolutely was. I think he was playing through the middle at that point.
Right.
He dived wide, got switched to the middle.
Yeah.
When we were getting desperate. And yeah, I think he dribbled through the middle, got fouled, and yeah, then we had Acosta. So, I mean, there's an argument for Pulisic playing central, definitely. out of everybody, that's better than getting 100% out of Bruno Sick and 70% out of everybody else. I'm sure that's not how the math actually works, but I embellished to sort of prove my example.
Yeah, sure. Circling back to Zusi, I mean, they have to go. You said Yedlin is going to be the guy. I think he's healthy. He played recently for Newcastle.
Yeah, he's 2 games into his sort of Newcastle comeback and doing fine, is he?
So let's talk about the Timmy Chandler kind of situation, because I guess the schools of thought there are he's not interested, or Bruce is afraid that in this big a moment he might not be interested, which I think might even be a little more fair way of saying that he's not interested. I also think that the Cuba call made him kind of mad. You know, there are kind of rumblings from his camp that he wasn't thrilled about being there, and that his club in particular were irritated. He took a nasty, he was tackled. There's a nasty tackle towards the end of that game on him. you know.
Was it with the game down in Cuba?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that he was there, but there were a lot of players that didn't look happy to be there, and I think diplomatically it was great, but as a soccer match in a field, it was clear that nobody was excited. Right? It was the first time I saw Christian Pulisic looking sort of not thrilled to be playing for the U.S. men's national team.
Right.
I think that goes back to a Jurgen Klinsmann type thing of he wants to sort of make people uncomfortable and make them prove themselves. So you know that Timmy Chandler sort of has some problems with the travel for the U.S. national team. He has problems going to tough CONCACAF places. So rather than accommodating him, it seemed that he was sort of like, well, you want to get back in this team, you got to go play in Havana. It sometimes when you push people too far, you break them, right?
Right.
I feel like Clinsmann always had this thing of, I push people far, and they're forged in fire, and then they're better for it. But sometimes you just break them. Some things just burn in the fire and never come back.
No, it's true. Nine days on the Google search here. It took 9 days from that match to where his coach at Frankfurt says Chandler should reevaluate his national team priorities. And
I guess that's where it is, though, right? That he's not. Chandler's maybe not 100% in, so Bruce Arena's sort of like, well, I'm not going to risk it. And he trusts Graham Susie more maybe anyway, so that's what we got.
Right, and he called him in June, and then Chandler withdrew, claiming that he had a muscle injury in his last game of the Bundesliga season. You know, but I guess Arena still thought, I'm going to bring him in, and then he didn't come, and we haven't seen him since.
So maybe that was the final straw.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a hard call because, to some extent, you know, if you could have him and you could play him where Villafania is, I would prefer that just because I think he's a better soccer player. But it's not, you know, national teams aren't built like that necessarily either.
I feel like from what I've seen of him in the Bundesliga, he is 100% a better soccer player than the guy we've seen play for the U.S. men's national team. But I'm sympathetic to the idea that we are quite a few years into Timmy Chandler's international career, and I don't really see it changing. So he may just have to go down in history as one of those guys that was better for his club team than his national team.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a point I've made a lot, which is that his two or three best matches have all been either in Germany or an hour and a half long ride on a bullet train from Germany. You know, like once he and against Honduras in a World Cup qualifier in the last cycle, it was an absolute horror show.
Yeah, that was March 2013, right?
Right, and that was that was Roger Espinosa at like the height of his career.
Yeah,
but I mean, it was a horror show. It wasn't Steve Cherundolo, James Milner, take me out of the game, please. But it was close. Like, Bob Bradley might have substituted him.
So,
for whatever that's worth.
I don't expect to see Timmy Chandler's name when this role comes out.
In terms of, and I want to, the one question somebody, John Levy, the other preview writer, he writes most of the previews, really. John wanted to know, so John watches the Bundesliga a lot, and his feeling is that if the U.S. have a player that can play by themselves up top, it's Bobby Wood. And he said, ask Daryl about Bobby Wood. So now I've done so.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree with, I mean, John's a smart guy because I read his previews. I agree that if we're going to go with one striker, Bobby Wood is probably the best equipped to do it. I'm saying that as someone, again, going back to the whole jigsaw thing, I'm a huge admirer of Jose Altidore. I really think he's a very, very, very good soccer player with a lot to offer, but I think he needs a striker. He has to have someone else alongside him because he's not great at just sort of just doing that sort of kind of simple work of just chasing footballs and holding the ball up and all that.
Right.
I think Bobby Wood, he's not perfect at it, right? But it's not, I would say it's Bobby Wood's sort of best game. He's probably better with a strike partner as well. But Bobby Wood is slightly better at it. He's better at sort of receiving the ball and turning and all that kind of stuff. And I guess, yeah, if we're going to go with one striker, it maybe should be Bobby Wood.
So what was instructive to me about it, about that comparison you just made is actually the Honduras game, right?
Yeah.
I know he was a sub, so that's a little different because he didn't have, I don't know how frustrated you get on a sideline. I imagine there's some frustration there. But my pretty consistent criticism of Altidore, and I'm also a fan of his and one of the people that said I think he got better through all the tribulations at Sunderland, which I know is not a particularly popular take, but he's been a much better target and hold-up player since he returned. I don't think that's coincidental. But I think what happened also at Sunderland that got worse was his tendency to I don't want to say he checks out of games. That's not particularly fair. But he certainly is prone to spells where if things aren't going well or if things are going against him, you know, he's a little slow to react. He's maybe a little slow to chase the ball.
Yeah. Do you know what? Here's what it is. I've just realized my way of describing it earlier maybe wasn't ideal. What I think is, the reason I like Jose Altidore with a partner is because then he can stay involved by coming deep and connecting passes a little bit, like instead of being the guy that has to play on the shoulder of the last defender.
Right.
I think that's where he's not happy and not very effective. Because you need, for people who aren't, like, you know, so familiar with soccer tactics, when you play that system, you usually need your number nine, your striker, to stay high on the opposition defence so that they're always worried about the ball over the top, right? So it seems that when Altidore plays as the lone striker, he obviously is told you need to stay up, you can't keep coming deep. And then he's kind of like, okay, I'll do it, but this isn't my favourite place to be. Whereas Bobby Wood seems a lot happier just kind of towing that off sideline and being the threat in behind and staying high all the time. And I think that's the major difference between the two in terms of playing that position.
I think that's right, and I think what's interesting is that in the Honduras win, it was, you know, that was a game where Altidore did apply high pressure to center backs.
Yeah.
And I think Pinto, having just spoken to him about it, was stunned by it. Like he said, I couldn't believe that they came out and played Josie high, and Pinto's quote to me was, I thought Josie would get bored within half an hour.
Right.
And he didn't. And the U.S. just eviscerated them. But Altidore's...
Yeah, but that game, didn't Altidore play alongside someone else?
He did. But he's not... Even with a partner, he's not necessarily a traditional number nine, is he? Because he likes to come back.
Yeah.
And
that's always my argument. He looks like a number nine. He's kind of big and wide. So he looks like someone you should, like, use as a target. But he's really much better with the ball on the floor.
He's a tremendous passer, isn't he?
Yeah.
Do you think that, I mean, we get these so many of these ridiculous comparisons. I mean, the comparisons for Altidore from, you know, fans that don't watch as much. Oh, he's like Emil Heskey. I mean, is that ridiculous?
I think Heskey's very different in that my take on Heskey is he was always a winger when he was like 19, 20, maybe up to like 22. But because he was a big guy, someone in English football thought, big guy should play up front, and they sort of made him go and play centre forward. And the other thing I always thought about Heskey, because I lived through this hard, is that Heskey is just a kind of gentle, nice man. He would never really be super aggressive and imposing. When I think the flip side is that Altidore, when he comes to play, he is super aggressive, like he is in your face. Wasn't he suspended for the last game because he got a yellow card?
I think
if Jersey is much more of a competitor, and also Jersey is much more of an actual striker, much more of like
questions, I guess. The first would be the Costa Rica match. Much ado about the one in the one we never should have played at Red Bull Arena.
Oh, I see.
were you? There's two schools of thought on it. Interestingly, some say the U.S. were outclassed by Costa Rica, lost. It's a second home match they lost. That's really bad. Others say, you don't want to lose at home, but they played and tried to impose their style on a team that is pretty good. I fall kind of in between.
Yeah.
Such a cop-out, but where stands Daryl Grove?
I think we're here in the middle. But yeah, I don't know if you heard this or not, but we interviewed Bobby Warshaw after this game, and he was kind of the guy that brought up the idea that essentially this was the U.S. trying to play an attacking style, he called it Fun Bruce, trying to like Bruce Arena, being like, yeah, let's just get all our attacking weapons out there and go at them. And that he was just all in on that. And even though it ended badly, he thinks that Bobby Warshaw thought that that's the way the U.S. soccer moves forward, is to be the team that just says, here's all our attacking pieces, do your best against them, we're going to win. Whereas, and I agree with that. I think I agree with that idea, because that sounds fun, right?
Yeah.
But I think it was kind of naive to do that against Costa Rica and leave Michael Bradley kind of abandoned in midfield.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about that, and this kind of ties in well with the Panama matches, what makes Panama so good, I think, more than players? And again, I like their midfield personnel a lot.
Yeah.
I think Roman Torres is a guy that's getting older. I think they have nice young pieces in defense, but it's not perfect personnel by any stretch of the imagination.
No, we were criticizing Mario in the U.S. Open Cup final for failing to read Latif Blessing's jump, failing to jump at all, in case he's got that winner. So, yeah, I'm guaranteed, Taylor is incensed about that. So I'll guarantee if Mario's starting for Panama, Taylor will be happy.
That's good. I was going to identify Mario as somebody that I thought the U.S. could exploit a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'll have to go back and look at that Open Cup moment. But Panama plays a system, right? And they play it from U17 to U20 to U20. It's the same at every level. And so when they get into a national camp, even if it's a pop-up camp where, you have a day of practice and a friendly, there's like people know their roles. And this is sort of one of the strengths of Bruce Arena, I think, is that he's great at suggesting what roles are for players and sort of telling them what to expect in the most simplistic way.
Yeah.
But the U.S. certainly don't have anything that would remotely... I don't think that they have anything that would remotely be characterized as like a national team system or style, necessarily. Like, it's all very pragmatic, and sometimes that's good, but these smaller countries are tougher to play against sometimes because they do, and this is the way that Roman Torres has been playing for 14 years, right?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's interesting. It's an interesting thought that Bobby Warshaw had about, hey, if the U.S. is going to move to a style, maybe there's a growing pain game like this where you create a bunch of chances and lose because the other team has Keylor Navas.
Well, I think now is if we're going to do that, we have to do it outside of a World Cup cycle and give it a few friendlies.
Yeah.
And maybe it just, bet the style down, and then we go into, especially if you go into, I know they're going to change in CONCACAF qualifying, but if you go into the early stages, you can roll out that style against St. Kitts or someone, and really sort of, you've got a bit more leeway for error. But then the problem is, I think I called it kind of naive earlier, is if you roll out that style against Costa Rica or any other team that sort of has a defined system, I'd include Honduras and Panama, as you talked about, right, the same system all the way through the youth teams up to the senior team, then often, unfortunately, the system wins.
Yeah.
Come like 1984, the system wins.
The new national record. Do you think that U.S. soccer made the switch too late? I mean, do you think that after they lost the playoff to Mexico, maybe they should have...
It felt like the right time to wave Klinsmann goodbye and bring in someone new. I think they maybe just kept hoping that it would turn around, and then obviously Costa Rica makes the result.
parchment about this, and, you know, Wilf's position on it was that for a Long Islander like Arena, that's motivating. Bruce.
Yeah,
he's the best, right? That he said, you know, he's gonna say he's from New York, and this is his last go. Like he doesn't need money. He's just doing this because he wants to.
Yeah, he doesn't need to make his reputation. He doesn't need to do that. I think that's maybe part of the reason we saw that attacking lineup against Costa Rica. Bruce Arena just thinking, here it is.
Right, and so it will be. You know, because I don't know, and I will decide before I finish the preview for Panama whether or not I think the U.S. will need a playoff or not. And like I said, I'm leaning to yes. Right now, you know, gun to head, I think it's draw, win, and that's playoff.
Draw at home and be treated away.
Right.
And playoff.
Right. With a very nervy, like, first half hour in Port of Spain, right?
not Port of Spain, right? They've moved into that small stadium.
Oh, that's right. They have.
Yeah.
That, you know what? That pitch is nicer.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, my wife is from Trinidad, so I know these things. It was a nicer pitch. The other one is, it's got a giant track around it.
Yeah.
You've seen it.
Yeah, I have. I've seen it in 1989 for Kanagari, I assume it's maybe changed a little bit since then, but probably not that much.
They actually have the same grass.
Oh,
no, I'm kidding.
I thought it was like that sort of, I don't know what you call it, the fable of the same brew. But if you sort of change all the bristles and change the handle and change the head of the broom, it's still eventually, you can call it the same broom even though every part of it is different.
Michael Bradley told me the nicest part of that stadium is the locker rooms. And it's like, you just let your imagination go on that one, but
yeah.
I thought it was funny. So let's close.
I sidetracked this, but what
were we doing? Yeah, I want to close with goalkeepers.
Oh, okay.
Because I thought the U.S. would have actually maybe tied Costa Rica or maybe won. But it was weird. So I went through, I was trying to think in my head. I was like, when's the last time a U.S. goalkeeper in a competitive match, not a friendly, was outplayed to the extent where you could argue maybe that's why the U.S. lost?
You mean before Costa Rica?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It was almost impossible. I couldn't think of something. And I had a Twitter follower who said, well, what about the Czech Republic game at the World Cup in 2006? And I said, I don't know. They kind of forgot to mark Jan Koller. Not that you could mark him, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, it's not really like a lot that could have been done in about the first two goals in that game. So I was like, that seems a little harsh.
Yeah.
You know, I know that at that point in his life, Casey Keller was, what, superhuman, but. So yeah, I couldn't think of a game. I thought that, you know, the argument I made was that maybe in 2010 against Ghana, the Boateng goal, I thought it was soft. But then I watched it again, and maybe it wasn't. It looked like Timmy was screened, and he had a rib injury. So...
Sorry, I lost you.
No, I know. Yeah, no.
I think the Skype connection went. I heard something, and then boating, and then...
Yeah, okay. So what I said was, I thought that maybe the round of 16 game in 2010, Howard was to blame for the Boateng goal.
Oh, okay.
Because he was beat near post. And I said he had a rib injury, but it's not like the Ghana goalkeeper made any spectacular plays in that game. So.
No, in fact, I couldn't even tell you who the Ghana goalkeeper was. I can't remember his name.
I know he played for Pirates in South Africa. It's a club. Their nickname is the Pirates. That's all I remember. So, yeah, you can't think of one. I mean, do you think, I kind of wish that Tim Howard were in the, like, Tony Meola 2002 position, where, like, he were on the team, and they're like, oh, what a great leader to have in the locker room. And then, you know, kind of stopped there.
but not necessarily on the field.
But they're not. They're going to play this World Cup with Tim Howard or Brad Guzan, aren't they?
I think so. I'm going back and forth on this. So Arena's comments seem to be, you know, I'm going to trust my experienced guys through the end of the hex, and that's going to get us there. But then you've still got, even if it takes till November with the playoff, right, you've still got a good, like, 7 months in between and probably lots of friendlies and definitely about 3 warm-up games is what you normally get before you go to the World Cup.
Right.
And I think there might be that part of, that Long Island part of Bruce Arena might just be, all right, let's see what we got. Let's see what Ethan Horvath's all about. Let's see Tyler Adams and Weston McKennie. Let's see what they can contribute. Let's see. Let's give this Josh Sargent kid a call up and see what happens. You know what I mean? I'd love to see him really roll the dice and see even if like only one of those players works out and he thinks, yeah, this guy's ready for the World Cup. And I think it'll be Weston McKennie between you and I and anybody listening.
Yeah, I think
really
so too.
It's possible that he does some experiments between now and the World Cup, and then we have this slightly fresher feel about us.
That makes sense. Who's the kid in Liga Emeka too? I think he might get a look, but...
Oh, his name is Jonathan Gonzalez?
Yeah.
I think?
Yeah.
He's in Monterrey, right?
Yeah.
We haven't seen him going, but I know people are talking very excitedly about him. So, yeah, that's another one. You could just see him pop up in a friendly. Maybe he scores and everyone's like, oh, who's this? And Bruce Arena's, I don't know, but let's keep playing him. And then we kind of see where we go from there.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I know you guys have a show to do, so I won't put you on the spot or ask for predictions, but you feel okay about this game in Orlando? It's going to be hot. There will be, I hate to break it to all the Red Bull Arena people, but there will be 4,000 to 5,000 Panama fans there, I would imagine. Certainly, when the U.S. has played them in Tampa, they've always had a pretty large contingent. That's a 1.5-hour drive. You know, I mean, where's your confidence level?
It's a thing. Weirdly, I'm not confident about the game because I've got this feeling it's going to be so puffed up and hyped up. And then the way that Panama play means that they're going to be kind of tough to break down. So it's going to be a frustrating 90 minutes, at least based on the last couple of times the US has played Panama.
Yeah.
One every time. It's frustrating, but also with some threat, especially those wingers you talked about and Gabby Torres bursting through the middle. Like, there's so many heart-sinking moments that I can imagine of, like, Panama hitting us on the break with Torres' pace, maybe.
Yeah.
But at the same time, because it's been so long since the US failed to qualify for a World Cup, I've got this weird sort of, that'll never happen, kind of, you know what I mean? Like, I've got this weird, it'll work out kind of feeling, even though I'm scared, not scared, even though I'm nervous specifically about the game.
Yeah.
But sometimes nerves is just excitement, right? So, I guess that's a very rambling way of saying, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I don't either. I have these visions of Omar Gonzalez, emergency defender, like closing on Blas Perez, who comes off the bench in like the 75th minute.
Yeah.
And I just don't even want to repeat the rest of the fear there. It's relatively obvious. I did see there will be a Mexican referee crew.
Interesting.
Yeah, just, you know, okay.
Well, they owe us some favors, right?
Yeah.
From the San Jose moment, so maybe that's good.
They're also probably the best referees in CONCACAF.
Oh, I think, yeah, that's interesting.
So that's good, I think. You know, because I think that the strategy against Pulisic is relatively obvious now. So if we could just get, yeah, if we could just get a crew that calls those, that would be terrific.
Sorry to sidetrack a little, but did you see Arena talking about Pulisic being fouled? His response was essentially, it's up to Christian to sort of learn to make the most of that, like to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
And I think playing him in the middle and getting fouled near the top of the box for the equaliser, eventually the equaliser against Honduras, was maybe a sign that we were seeing Christian Pulisic figure that out.
Yeah,
maybe that's
the
best argument for playing. Best argument for playing him central is if they're going to foul him, they can foul him 25 yards from goal in a straight line, so someone can step up and bang a free kick.
Well, I hope that they do, so that Clint Dempsey can celebrate another weird free kick that escapes a wall and a goalkeeper. Daryl, thank you for your time today.
I enjoyed it.
And hopefully we can catch up again soon with the U.S. safely qualified to another World Cup.
Yeah,
So that was my interview with Daryl Grove. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope that you enjoy the game tonight. I don't think it'll be pretty, but I'm feeling better as time goes on that the U.S. will get the job done and put themselves in a position to qualify automatically for the World Cup next week in Trinidad. Once again, Neil Blatton for the Yanks Are Coming Soccer Show. And we will be with you again shortly with Kartik Krishnire in tow.